This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Sitting in my studio here in Philadelphia, I'm staring at two large clock faces that are both analog and digital. There are also three countdown clocks. My life for 2 hours each weekday morning is ruled in many ways by time. And if the interview goes well, the time really does fly. And if it goes poorly, well, it can be a very long hour. Our guest, Claudia Hammond, knows a lot about the elasticity of time. She's the author of a book called Time Warped, Unlocking the Mysteries of Time Perception. It includes many stories, including a hair-raising one about a skydiver whose parachute broke and his thoughts and feelings about time as he hurtled through space. Claudia Hammond is a broadcaster for the BBC, a lecturer in psychology, and she joins us from the NPR Bureau in New York. And Claudia Hammond, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, you just flew in from Britain, and I'm assuming dealing with some degree with jet lag. Does jet lag affect the experience of time?
Yes, I mean, jet lag is one of those things that, of course, you know, humans weren't made to be travelling around the world at the speeds that we can do. And so, of course, our bodies haven't caught up with that. And so jet lag is something that still does very much throw our body clocks because, you just can't get used to it that quickly. And it's estimated to take, you know, a day to get used to each hour's time zone that you've moved. So at the moment, I feel fine at this moment. But by early evening, each evening in New York, I'm starting to flag just as, you know, the city is getting more and more lively.
Well, hopefully in a couple of days you'll have a chance to enjoy it. I'm curious about your interest in time, how you got interested in this notion of time, especially the perception of time.
Well, I wrote a book previously about emotions and the science of emotions and what we know about those. And while I was looking into all the research for that, I noticed there seemed to be quite a few experiments where time perception was involved. And so what I'm interested in is very much our subjective experience of time. So it's not the physics of time. You know, we physicists will argue about what rate it is that time passes and how it does that, but our experience of it passing. And I noticed that this seemed to be linked to lots of emotional things, and that in a sense we never quite get used to the strange tricks that time plays on us. It speeds up when we don't expect it to, and it feels as if it goes slowly at other times. And that's something we never quite get used to, and that's what got me really interested in it. You know, not all minutes are the same. They don't feel the same. We might know that they are objectively the same, but if you imagine, you know, you've got a 20-minute break for lunch and you're quickly grabbing a sandwich with a friend and you're just chatting, that 20 minutes will be gone in absolutely no time. You'll look at your watch and it'll be time to go back to work. If your train is 20 minutes late and they keep saying it's going to be here in 1 minute and then it's not and it's not and it's not, and that goes on for 20 minutes, that will seem like a very, very long 20 minutes. And so every day we have these experiences showing us that not all time feels the same.
Well, indeed, and I want to pick up on all of that, but one of the things I note about you in this book is that for you, Monday is the color red, and I'm interested in, and I know there's a name for people that experience time in terms of colors or even shapes.
Yeah, so this is thought to be a type of synesthesia. So synesthesia is a thing that quite a lot of people experience where any of the senses can get mixed up with each other. And one of the most common ways for that to happen is for colours to be associated with letters or numbers, and also for colours to be associated with days of the week. And so whenever I think about Monday, I'll get a kind of sense of red. Mm-hmm. And it stays continuous and it stays consistent throughout life, and I Tuesday is blue and Wednesday is orange. There's all these different colours, and they're not the same for different people. And as many as one in five people seem to experience time laid out in space in this way. And so, I very much see the months of the year as an oval, and they go anti-clockwise. And if somebody says to me, you know, are you free in October to do this? I'm immediately looking sort of up to the right and thinking of October. Now, only one in five people experience this. So for the other four in five, this can sound like it's very strange. And how do you know people aren't making it up? But you can do tests on the computer and prove this is consistent.
But I'm wondering whether, because of the way that you perceive time as shapes and colors, whether your experience of time is, for instance, different from mine. Is there any way to know that?
I think what we do know is that people who see time laid out in this way are often better at remembering when certain things are going to happen and when they need to do things. They're also quicker at certain tasks involving doing sort of mental manipulations with the months. You know, if you get someone to count the months backwards in threes going from November backwards, that's a sort of tricky task. But people who see time laid out can do that faster and can even sort of use the number lines, if you like, to do sums and so on.
Because of the kind of associations, strong associations and consistent associations that you have with time.
That's right, because you're always sort of seeing it laid out like that, and I'd always assumed that everybody saw it laid out, you know, originally, until I, you know, knew more about it and found that only one in five people see it in this way.
In my introduction, I referenced this story about a hang glider guy, and his name really is Chuck Berry.
His name is Chuck Berry. he's not that Chuck Berry.
No, I didn't know if that was a pseudonym or whatever. But
yeah, that is his name. But he's a New Zealand sort of a daredevil, and he lives in New Zealand and goes around the world doing extraordinary things. You know, he's jumped off the KL Tower and, you know, opened in Kuala Lumpur, which is so tall, and it opens a parachute right at the last moment, and he does all these amazing daredevil things. And then one day he was out in a kind of glider. It's a sort of glider where you can run along to take off because your feet stick out of the bottom, so you can run along a hill and take off. And he was playing tricks and doing loop the loop and things like that. And then suddenly the glider's wings started to flutter the wrong way, and they sheared off. And he realized that this plane was going to crash. This glider was going to crash, and just managed to get to a parachute in time, pulled the parachute cord, and then found he was still falling really fast because it turned out to be a really tiny parachute. And he describes how in those moments where he was absolutely convinced he was going to die, time slowed right down. And this is something very common that people experience if they really think their life is in danger. And, you know, I've had this just in a car crash that can only have taken, I don't know, 20 seconds felt to me like it took 5 minutes. You know, I thought about so many things. And he said exactly the same thing. As he was careering towards the ground, he thought about so many things, it felt as if it really took ages. And then luckily he landed in some bushes in the end, and so he hurt his wrist a bit, but amazingly survived this extraordinary fall. But he says it's never left him, this sense of time slowing down like that.
Well, and you quote some of the things that he remembers thinking, where he says, "What would James Bond do? Come on, dude, do something. I have to do something. Don't look at the ground. It's too close. There's no time. There has to be a way. It must have been a flutter. The lever for the emergency chute. If I can just get to the lever, I should be there. Surely it has to be there. How long have I been falling for this?" And on and on. But you say it was about 10 seconds of this fall, but it felt obviously a lot longer for him.
Yes, it absolutely stretched out for him. And this is very common. And one of the reasons is that we know that fear narrows our focus. So you start concentrating only on the things that can save yourself. So, you know, he's concentrating on where this lever is and how he can save himself with that. And you stop noticing anything else going on. So if you're in a car, you stop noticing the other cars passing or the music changing on the radio, all those things you'd normally use to work out the time passing. And at the same time, we know that strong emotions create stronger memories. So this strong fear etches those memories into your mind, and you judge how much time has passed by how many memories you've made. And so it feels as if it took much longer than it did.
Kind of obviously hyper focus or kind of overdrive, as you describe in this book.
That's right. So you're absolutely focused. I mean, sensibly, you know, you need to be absolutely focused on anything that might save you is what you look at. And that's what makes the time perception feel so different. That's what warps the time in that experience.
You also describe I guess he's a BBC journalist, a guy named Alan Johnston. He was held hostage for about 4 months. It sounds like largely held in solitary or clearly by himself. Mm. And what happened to time for him?
Yeah, so he had all sorts of extraordinary experiences with time. I mean, he was taken hostage in Gaza, and he knew this might happen. I mean, he knew it was a risk, and he was only going to work there a few more weeks, and was then coming back to work in London for a while before going somewhere else. But he was held up at gunpoint and pushed into a car, and at that moment, he said time went really, really slowly. He had the same experience of time going so slowly because he was so scared. But then in the 4.5 months while he was held, of course, he didn't know it was going to be 4.5 months. He had no idea whether it would be, you know, years and years or lot. And of course, there'd been other, you know, journalist hostages who'd been kept for many years. And he feared this might be happening to him. And he was in this room in a flat, locked in on his own. And there was nothing in there apart from a white plastic chair and a mattress that he slept on. So he said, time really, of course, did hang really heavy. He didn't have a pen and paper or anything, and the hours just went so slowly. And he said to me, if you want to imagine what it's like, imagine you clear a room in your flat of everything apart from a white plastic chair, and then you sit on this chair for a few hours, and then have a little walk about, and then sit there again for 2 hours, then sit there again for another 3 hours, and even then it's not time to go to bed yet. And he used to stay up as late as possible in order to be able to sleep as long as possible next morning, to feel as if he'd missed a bit of the next day, if you like. And then they gave him a radio, which he was really pleased with, and he listened on the radio to the BBC World Service all the time that he worked for. And he listened, and he would hear stories about, he knew they were looking for him and so on. And then one night, time slowed right down again, because he heard on the bulletin that he'd been executed. Oh. And so, of course, he knew his parents would have heard this, and he thought, of course, that they must be going to come to do this. They must have let out the announcement too early, if you like, sent out the press release too early, and that they'd already announced this and that they were going to come and do it. So, of course, whenever he then heard any noises, and when they brought him his food and so on that evening and that night, he thought he was going to be killed again. And he said, again, he had this experience of time absolutely slowing right down in the absolute terror of that.
Well, and it's interesting to think about what, as we all know, I mean, a minute is 60 seconds, but it's interesting to think about what the brain is doing, I guess, as it's processing, in the case of Alan Johnson, this terrible situation that he's in, and of course, being kind of buffeted by news and his own mind on top of that.
Yeah, so in a sense, yeah, so he's got the fear to deal with, and he decided he was very determined that although his captors could control everything about his life, that the one thing they couldn't control was his mind, and he was very mm-hmm. determined to do anything he could to sort of hold on to his mind and hold on to his sanity. And he actually found time was a reassuring thing, because mm-hmm. he knew that he couldn't make anything happen, but the one thing that was going to happen was that time was going to move on without him. You know, he may live there till he was an old man, he may get killed earlier on, he may get released, but something would happen in the end, and he found that something that he found very reassuring, in a sense.
We're almost up on a break here, but did he sort of think about his life? I can only imagine, if you have all that time on your hands, perhaps you sort of go back over the periods of your life and relive them through your memories.
Yes, he said he would deliberately decide, you know, oh, today I'm going to think about you know, my first year at school, what can he remember? And he would try and remember all sorts of things he'd done with his family when he was little, and almost savour those moments. You know, he'd almost space out those moments so that he could just enjoy those memories and try to, you know, escape, mm-hmm. in a sense, mentally from the situation that he was in.
And again, that's Claudia Hammond, our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She's a broadcaster for the BBC, also a lecturer in psychology and author of a book titled Time Warped, Unlocking the Mystery of Time Perception. She joins us from the NPR Bureau in New York. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, also open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We have all had the experience of the elasticity of time. We want your stories. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
One in three families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
What can you do when angry, stinging insects are zeroed into your rear end? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal several safe and sane ways to handle aggressive wasps and hornets, plus answers to an especially large selection of your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
What is it to be American? Is it all steam engines in progress? Or is it partly about a relationship with the wide open spaces and the animals that live there, even the ones that are kind of scary?
You know, it's why we still have, you know, a buffalo on our coin and RVs with wolves airbrushed on them. These animals are symbols of kind of a real America.
I'm Jesse Thorne, People and Animals in America, on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Claudia Hammond about the science of time and why something that is so constant can feel so flexible, so unreliable. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Claudia, one of the things that you say about time or about the brain is that the brain, quote unquote, counts time. Take us inside the brain. How is the brain counting time?
Yeah, it's fascinating because it's something of a mystery, and yet we are very good at, if you do experiments where you get people to estimate a minute passing or 2 minutes passing, we're quite good at it. And we also know what 20 minutes feels like. We know what 2 hours feels like, and we can guess something. And so for many years now, neuroscientists have tried to find, well, how is the brain doing this? Where is the clock, if you like, in the brain? And there's the body clock, which controls our 24-hour sleep-wake cycle. But that's very different from the subjective experience of time. So how is the brain doing this? So there's various theories, and there's various different areas of the brain which seem to be involved in it. And what is interesting is that nobody can find a single clock. There's no one place where if somebody, say, gets a brain injury, that then they can't judge time at all. But there are different areas where different durations of time can be affected. So, for example, people who have Parkinson's disease will often find the durations of about 2-3 seconds very difficult to judge in tests and harder than other people. And yet some people are better at things. So, for example, children with Tourette syndrome, so these are children who have uncontrollable tics, are actually better at judging durations of just over a second. And this seems to be because they very much have to use the front area of their brain has to become more active in order to try to control these tics, and so they actually become better at it. So there seem to be various different areas of the brain involved, but still nobody can find a single clock, which is what's really amazing. So then there's various different theories. Are we counting up, if you like, the packets of energy that we use in the mind? And so if you have a scary event, say, that's very difficult to process. It might take more neural energy, if you like, to process, and so then we count that up, and it seems as if more time has passed. It seems as if it went more slowly.
But another interesting thing you say is that an auditory event, something that you hear, appears longer than a visual one. And of course, as a radio person, I had to circle that because I thought that is an interesting observation. What does that tell us?
Yes, I mean, this is really interesting that this does seem longer. And so they can do various experiments where you show people lights on a computer screen and you play them the sounds. And so it does seem as though we're possibly using different neural systems when we judge different things. And yet all of these things come together to give us a perception of time passing as a smooth event. And so although we talk, say, about the past and the present and the future, those all we experience it as something that's smooth, that goes from, you know, the start of this interview is now the past, but it doesn't feel like that to us. You know, it feels as if this has been one long, smooth period of time passing.
Tell us about the holiday paradox, and then we'll get to some of our callers.
Yeah, so the holiday paradox, or maybe in the States it should be the vacation paradox, is that when right. You go away on vacation, it's very common for people to experience, you know, you've been looking forward to it for ages and ages and saving up, and you go off on holiday, and then it seems to go very fast. There's all these new things to do and you're really busy, and say you're going away for a week, in no time at all it seems like you're halfway through the week and you're already thinking about packing and how you're going to get back home again. And yet when you get home, you look back and it feels as if you've been away for much longer than a week. And this will even happen in a weekend. As long as you go and do something different and you go away, it suddenly seems as though it's taken longer. And so I call this the holiday paradox. And the reason for it is that whenever we're judging time passing, We look at it in two different ways. We look at it prospectively. We say, how fast is time passing right now? You know, am I interested in this? Am I bored? How fast is it going right now? And then we also look back and we say, what was yesterday evening like? How did time pass there? And we very much judge how much time has passed when we look back by how many new memories we've made. Mm. So when you go on holiday, you do loads more new things than you normally do in everyday life. You see sights that you've not seen before, just you walking down different streets. You make a load of new memories. So when you get back at the end of the holiday, you look back and it feels as if it took longer because there's all these different new memories, all these sights and sounds.
And does enjoyment affect that? I mean, if you had a good vacation, does the experience of time change? And one
yes,
hopes I mean, that one does.
Yeah. Yes, it does. And certainly at the time, when it comes to the prospective time estimation, if you're not enjoying your holiday, obviously it's going to seem as if it takes longer at the time, and particularly if you're bored, because we know that when people are bored, they pay too much attention. You start paying attention to time itself, and that makes it seem as if the time is going slowly. But when you look back afterwards, if you were bored, that time, and you didn't do lots of interesting things, and it was all a bit samey, that time will actually shrink and it will seem shorter, which is a bit like what happens if you've got flu, say. At the time, you're feeling ill, you're just wishing you felt better, and it seems very, very long that week when you're ill with flu. When you look back on it, you've hardly done anything, so it shrinks in the memory because there aren't these memories that you've made that we use to judge how much time passes.
Let me get you to tell another story, and then we'll get back to, or we will get to our callers, I should say. And this was, I guess this was a study done a number of decades ago, but nonetheless, it was a spelunker in France who spent 2 months in a deep, dark cave. Was this his idea?
Yes, he's an amazing guy, Michel Siffre. And he decided in the 1960s, when he was only in his 20s, that he noticed when he was potholing that the different time seemed to do different things and seemed to play tricks on him, and that he found it very difficult to judge how much time he'd been underground. And so he wondered how the body works out, what the time is, what days it is, and whether it's day and night. And so for 2 months, he ensconced himself in an ice cave in France, deep underground, and it was very hard for him to even get permission to do this. And he lived down there with a mattress. He just had this mattress that he lay on, and he had a record player and would play Mario Lanza records. And the deal was he didn't take his wristwatch with him, so he had no idea what time it was. And every day his friends camped up on the top in case there was an emergency, and every day he would phone them on this special telephone when he thought it was morning, when he was getting up. And really quickly, like within a few days, because it was dark down there, his body totally lost, and his mind totally lost any correct perception of time passing. And so he would soon be waking up these poor people at the top in the middle of the night, and they'd have to try and sound really awake when they answered. And he'd say, it's morning, here we are, and it wasn't at all. And so he actually so lost track of time that at the end of the 2 months, when they came to get him, he still had 25 days to go. And he didn't realise that at all, and he really thought he'd finished. And interestingly, although he didn't like it down there, he hated it down there, and he was lonely. He had a spider. He caught a spider, which became his only friend, and in the end he just used to talk to the spider all the time. And he was pleased that it was time to go, but interestingly he also felt cheated out of those 25 days. It's a bit like, you know, when you cross the date line in a plane and you kind of lose a day and you think, well, where was that day? Who's taken that day away from me? He felt as if 25 days had been taken away from him, and didn't like that at all. But at the same time, he founded the whole field of chronobiology, and this led to a much better understanding of the body clock and how it does need sun to reset it, or daylight to reset it every 24 hours, or we start going right off, you know, right off kilter.
Well, a little side issue I thought was interesting was he lost his appetite, and perhaps just, I mean, it sounded like the conditions were pretty harsh, and things got really messy down there. I mean, is that significant,
yes,
do you think?
Yes, I mean, he really didn't, you know, have a good time down there at all, even though he liked pot, you know, the rest of us, it might seem a horrendous idea going down there at all, but he liked potholing, so he did like it down there. And he was going to do loads of other experiments while he was down there, other scientific experiments, and he didn't really get round to doing those in the end, and he didn't. He even stopped playing his records, and his friends were really shocked when they got there, because there was sort of rubbish knee high, and they had to get all this rubbish out there, and he was really damp as well. He could never quite dry his socks out. His mattress and his camp bed got all wet, and he didn't have a good time down there at all, and was quite depressed in a sense down there. He didn't really like it.
But we should give a shout out to him, Michael Siffrey, for helping us understand the wake-sleep cycle, yes?
Absolutely, it was amazing. And had he not done that, it might have taken a lot longer for people to discover that. There'd already been, you know, some experiments with how people could survive in, say, atomic bomb shelters, and how people could survive there, and how what would happen to them. But no, he really did make it clear, and he's explained what happens to some people. Some people who are blind, if they can't detect light at all, then they can get this thing where they sort of free run. And so our bodies are set to have a day as just over 24 hours. And so they will get sort of 20 minutes out of sync every day. And that can very soon gets you sleeping in the daytime and being awake at night, and gets it all wrong. And he completely opened up this entire field that's been studied since.
Let me reintroduce you. And I do want to get some callers in on the conversation. That's Claudia Hammond. She's a broadcaster for the BBC, a lecturer in psychology, and author of a new book called Time Warped, Unlocking the Mysteries of Time Perception. Again, joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'd be interested in your questions, comments, and stories about time and time perception. Let me see what Kim from Upper Darby has to say. Kim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, this is really interesting to me. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have had many medical traumas and near-death experiences in my life, and I basically experienced, simply put, out-of-body experiences as if I was a witness, observer, from above or outside. It was as if, even though there was a lot happening, time was still. And that's how I experience time. It seems like past, present, and future merge together. And although I can feel things happening fast, it's as if everything is still. And I always feel like an observer. Mm. And I was just wondering if they've done a study on that. And I don't seem to plan or experience time in the way that people that in my life do.
Kim, that's very interesting. Claudia, do you have any thoughts?
Yes, I mean, there are definitely quite a lot of individual variations in the way that people experience time. And there are some people who are, you know, often, say, late and don't seem to experience time and be able to plan in the same way as others. And it's not that they're not trying and being late, but there are some people who don't seem to be able to sense time in the same way. Some people have linked this to dyslexia. Some people with dyslexia also find it difficult to judge time. And there are various, you know, computer tests that can be done to demonstrate this. And some people will be, say, you know, given extra time in exams because they can't judge when they're halfway through that time in the same way. So they're definitely are variations in the way that individuals experience time, and we don't all experience it in the same way.
Well, speaking of dyslexia, you write about ADHD as a disorder of time perception, and that for many people with ADHD, time feels what, slowed down?
Yeah, this was really fascinating research that was done in London, where they found that for people who were asked to say when 3 minutes has passed, the people with ADHD would think it was over way before. So in other words, time was going really slowly for them. So if you ask a child with ADHD to sit still for 5 minutes and concentrate on something, that time will actually feel much longer than them. And they found that using these time estimation tasks, they were able to correctly identify 70% of cases of ADHD, suggesting that possibly ADHD might be a disorder of some sort of disorder of time perception. And it's interesting that disorders of time perception seems to be involved in other conditions as well. And so, for example, if people are experiencing depression, they will experience time going twice as slowly as other people do, which again can be measured on time tests. And so people are actually experiencing it as something different.
Mm. And even boredom, boredom slows down time as well.
Yes, certainly. If we're feeling bored, we start paying attention to time itself. And you know, we all know, you know, a watched pot never boils. Once you pay attention to time itself, time goes even more slowly and feels as if it's going more slowly. And the same happens if people are feeling rejected. There was an extraordinary experiment done where they got a load of people in a room and they got them all to chat with each other at the beginning, and they had name badges on, and they got them to talk about what music they liked and where they'd been on holiday. And then they said, we're going to be working in pairs, so we'd like you to put down the name of somebody you'd like to work with. And they called them in one at a time, and with half the people, one at a time, they said to them, the experimenter would sort of shift uncomfortably and say, I'm really sorry about this. This has never happened before, but nobody put you down. I'm afraid nobody chose to work with you. Mm. And so this poor person is feeling rejected and thinking, I've only just met these people. Why do they all hate me so much? And then they say, so it's better if you work in this room on your own. And they go and work on their own. With the other half of the people, they say to them, well, this is amazing. We've never had this before, but every single person put you down. You must be really, really popular. So these people are feeling good about themselves and thinking, oh, all these strangers really like me. How great. So they say it's only fair if you work on your own because everyone wants to work with you. And then they've got all these people in rooms, half of them feeling sad, half of them feeling happy. And the first test they give them is a test of time perception. And those people who are feeling rejected, time actually feels to them as if it's going more slowly. And again, on these tasks, they will get the timings wrong. You know, they will think that time is actually going more slowly than it is for the happy people. And it's almost because if you're feeling rejected, you start focusing, you know, in on yourself. You're wondering what it is about you that these people don't like, and that seems to slow down our time perception.
Let me get Meredith from Germantown to join our conversation. Hi, Meredith. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yes, I also think this is a really interesting conversation, and one of the things that I've kind of reiterated with some of my friends and just other people is that time seems to be speeding up as we get older, especially in comparison to free time, like in the summertime. When I was a child, it seemed 4 weeks, 8 weeks was a lifetime, and now, you know, it's just a blink of an eye. And I'm curious if there's been any research or feedback about that.
Meredith, thanks for the call. Claudia, you look at that in your book. It's right in your wheelhouse. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very common for people to say that, you know, time seems to be speeding up as you get older. And as you say, you know, the summer vacation used to just seem like forever. And now, you know, everything just goes by in a blink of an eye. And it's always, you know, nearly the end of summer, nearly Christmas again, and nearly summer, nearly Christmas, just goes faster and faster. And there's various theories about why this happens. And one of the ones people often say is they'll say, oh, I know why this is. It's all to do with proportionality, that when you're 8, a year is only an eighth of your life. And when you're 40, it's a 40th of your life. So no wonder it seems to go by more quickly. But in a sense, that doesn't explain it. That just, you know, that just describes what's happening. Because if that held, then a single day at the age of 40 would absolutely flash by, because it's only 1/14,000th of your life so far. And that's not what people describe. People don't say that the individual days are going fast. What they find is that the weeks and the months and the years are going fast. And so I think the reason is back to the whole idea of the vacation paradox, the holiday paradox. And so we look at time in different ways. And when we look back on it, we look back on our lives, we have fewer new experiences as we get older. There are more routines, and there are less firsts in life. And so we remember fewer things, we make fewer new memories, and that makes time seem as if it's going that much faster. Because suddenly you see something, you know, I see things I own in vintage shops, and I think, you know, I'm 42, I think this is impossible, I own that. How can that be counted as vintage? And yet, of course, more years have gone by than I realize, and so it is.
But, and we're almost up in a break here, but I also wonder whether, if you're thinking about a two-year-old, I mean, a two-year-old essentially lives in the present.
That's right. I mean, two-year-olds don't, you know, we remember very little from when we're as small as that. And so, yes, they live in the present. They can't plan for the future in the same way. They you know, if you do experiments with three-year-olds, many of them can't suggest a plausible thing of what they might do the next day. They can't suggest what that might be. And so they very much are forced, in a sense, to live in the present in a way that we find very difficult to do as we get older.
And that's Claudia Hammond joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. She's a broadcaster for the BBC, a lecturer in psychology, and she's got a new book called Time Warped, Unlocking the Mysteries of Time Perception. And that's exactly what we're talking about here on Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation and back to our callers. Any questions or comments you might have, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The WHYY Connections Festival is back tomorrow and Sunday at the Great Plaza on Penn's Landing. Tomorrow, we rock with headliners They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. and Sunday switches to the sound of Philly soul, with the Soul Survivors, sensational soul cruisers, and again, more. Both days are free and open to the public, presented by WHYY and the Delaware River Waterfront Corporation. Learn more and register online at whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
You stay away from me, you son of a... You stay away from my family.
Oh, what? You gonna kill me, Gemma? Huh? Like you did the first husband.
That's Katie Sagal as Gemma, the fierce matriarch of the biker gang in Sons of Anarchy. Season 6 begins next week. We hear from Katie Sagal on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Congress and conscience.
My conscience said, do not give President Bush the authority to go into Iraq. Ever since, I have become more and more true to my principles.
A congressman from North Carolina says he won't get fooled again on U.S. military adventures in the Middle East. Jonesing on Syria next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Claudia Hammond about time and the perception of time, the subject of her new book called Time Warped. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Our lines just exploded. Let me get Christine from Elkton, Maryland to join us. Christine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, ladies. This conversation just so resonates with me.
Great.
I'm constantly having experiences where I think, how could I have thought that much in that short amount of time? I was mugged, and I had so many thoughts go through in that 30 seconds that, I, looking back on it, I find I have a lot of those experiences. But the other thing is the actual loss of the thought of time. I remember when I was delivering my child, it could have been 10 minutes, it could have been an hour, but, like, I had no concept of time in that moment versus moments of fear where you, I feel like you have a sense of time, but so many more thoughts went into it, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense, Christine. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Claudia, I'd be curious about your thoughts.
Yes, I mean, it is amazing how fast people can think and how much people can think about when they are in a really terrifying situation, you know, like Christine. And so we are able to think much faster than we can in other situations. You almost become, when you're afraid, you know, the best thinker you can ever be. You will think about all these things about what might happen and how you might be able to save yourself. And it's a really interesting, that juxtaposition that Christine made with this, the sense of the loss of time giving birth. And there's a concept within psychology known as flow. And this is almost where people are so absorbed in something. It's not exactly that time goes fast. It's that they're so absorbed in it that they feel as if they've stepped outside time. And it might be something, it could be something like giving birth, or it could be something like artists will often describe it, or it could be that people get it through gardening. You know, whatever it is, it's often something, you know, enjoyable or extraordinary in some way. And people will then experience time as something that isn't really happening at all, that they step outside it. And that fits in exactly with what Christine described there.
Christine, thanks for the call. And it also sounds a bit like how people will describe meditation or perhaps even prayer.
That's right. And so there have been various experiments looking at meditation and people deliberately stepping outside time using that. And there have also been experiments looking at this idea of how people can think so much faster during these experiences. There's some amazing experiments that the neuroscientist David Eagleman did, where he got people on a really, really scary high ride and he dropped them off it backwards, a bit like sort of being dropped off a skyscraper backwards. They get caught and they get caught in a cage, but it's very, very frightening because they feel as if they're falling to their deaths. And he did try it out 3 times himself, and it said that even the third time he said it was beyond scary. He didn't get used to it. But what he wanted to know was whether the brain is actually working faster. And so he had people, as they fell, look at these huge digital numbers flicking, and usually they're flicking too fast for the eye to see, for the human eye to be able to see. And he wondered if people were really scared and falling, would they be able to see these numbers? And in fact, they couldn't. So what it shows is that the brain isn't actually processing faster, but people are able to think faster. They're able to think more strongly, partly because that absolute focus is there, and that's a focus that's hard to have at other times, to be quite that focused as when you're really, really scared. And that's why people will often do amazing things when they're really frightened.
How do you get subjects to engage in an experiment like that of being pushed off buildings?
I know,
even
it's amazing,
if you're going to be caught
it?
At the other end.
I know. And he tried it with them going forwards, and he decided that wasn't scary enough. They needed to be falling backwards for it to be sufficiently frightening, although going forward sounds quite frightening to me.
Indeed. Let me see what Eric from Center City. Merida, thanks for the call. Eric, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hello.
Hi there.
Actually, my question comment is pretty much just what your past caller just said about getting mugged, and what you just mentioned about thinking fast. I had two brief experiences in my life where I experienced very intense situation where I felt like seconds had actually occurred in real life, but I experienced them as if an hour or a half hour had passed, where I was initially learning how to fly jets in the Navy, and as I had done that, I had to do tremendous amount of calculations and be aware of a number of different factors at the same time and make adjustments on an instant. And I could recall thinking back at that time in a matter of a second that took place. I could recall all the calculations and everything that my brain had processed in order for me to produce the result that I did. And there was another brief time in my life where I had a car accident, which I had no control of, and I could recall the time that took place was in the instant. It was probably maybe 2 seconds, but I could recall all the details as if they happened over minutes or a longer period of time. But what always amazed me, or what I guess part of my question is there a name for that type of intense, fast thinking? And is there a way, or is there anybody looking at how to achieve that? Because it was phenomenal. I mean, the rate at which I felt that I was able to process information and think.
Well, that's interesting, Eric, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Claudia, is there a name for that?
Yeah, no, there isn't actually a name for it. And it's, in a sense, it is just, you know, thinking really fast and faster than you can. And it's interesting, the question of whether it could be induced.
Yes.
And in a sense, it can only be induced by you being absolutely terrified for your life, because the reason we're able to do it when we're so frightened is that this is all about survival and trying to save yourself. And so if you are not under those pressures of that intense terror, then you're not going to be able to do it in the same way, because it's never going to be quite as necessary as if you're actually trying to save your life. Just as, you know, you sometimes see those amazing, you know, soldiers leap, where a soldier that was being chased has leapt across a gap that just seems completely impossible, and people can, you know, leap over walls that they could never climb normally if they're being chased and they think that they might die. And so in a sense, just as these physical things can happen, so the brain performs these amazing skills, but nobody can find a way, apart from terrifying people, and so unless you want to go around, you know, being dropped off backwards off buildings a lot,
thank you.
Of actually doing that the rest of the time, unfortunately. So then we have to stick with our rather slower thinking on an everyday basis.
Eric, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But I wonder, even picking up on his call, whether when you're learning something, and it sounds like he was learning to fly jets, obviously having to pay very close attention, whether time is different once you've actually learned to do that thing.
Yes, once something became a routine, if you like, so it's always going to be more stressful at the beginning when people are learning how to do it, and they're learning something as, you know, as life and death, if you like, as flying a jet. You've got to get that right. And so as people become more experienced, they're going to be calmer about that. And then obviously the idea is that, say, with pilots, that they become, you know, so experienced in the end that they can just do these things, and they just know how to do these things, and they can stay calm, because actually you do want your pilot to be calm if you want them to save you, because you want them to be able to think fast, but to think in the best way and not to panic, which is of course what experience teaches people to do, that it all kicks in and they're able to do what they're supposed to in an emergency.
There's a phrase in this country called highway hypnosis, which is that, you know, especially people that are used to driving to work, taking the same route every day, is that you get in your car to go home, you kind of disappear, mentally disappear. And next thing you know, you have driven up your driveway. You didn't kill anybody. You didn't have any accidents.
Yeah.
But you weren't there. And perhaps it's because you know this routine so well, you don't sort of have to be thinking about it or even processing it. But time,
yeah, that's right.
Time is so different.
Yeah, yeah. So if you've really not got to think about something, if you can just do it on autopilot, if you like, then you're not going to make any new memories, and so you're going to not remember that time because you've done that hundreds of times before. So you've not created anything new, and you know, as we go through life, as I was saying, you know, there are fewer of these firsts because there are more routines, and inevitably people have to have more routines. Say if they've got kids, because routine is good for the kids, and then that means they remember less themselves.
Thanks for the call, Eric. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Picking up on what you just said, Claudia, one of the things that you write in the book is that we're most likely to remember experiences that we had between the ages of 15 and 25, and that's because we're older, and these are new experiences. We're figuring things out in the world.
Yeah, that's right. It's a fascinating finding, this, and it's known as the reminiscence bump. And if you ask people to name a few songs that they really like, and to name some films or books that they've really enjoyed, often they will pick things that they read or came across between the ages of 15 and 25. And so this is known as the reminiscence bump, and more of our memories come from this time. And one of the reasons is that it's a time when we know that there's a second big burst of brain development. And so there's obviously the childhood brain development, but there is some more that happens between those ages, particularly 15 to 20. Also, it's very much a time when people are searching for identity. And so they're very much more likely to etch those memories strongly and to remember those memories, because those memories are starting to form them into the person that they are. And of course, there's more novelty at that time as well. You know, there's the first time going away without your parents, there's the first time moving, going to college, there's all these different things happening, and people will remember where they lived every single year, say between 18 and 25, and then later on you don't remember so well because you start to live in places for longer stretches, and there are fewer firsts because you've done all those things before. So one way, if you want time to seem slower, is to have lots of new experiences, to, if you like, recreate that holiday paradox of a weekend. Even if you're at home, make sure you go and do lots of new things. And by the end of that weekend, you will feel as if you've been away from work for a bit longer than usual.
Words to live by. Let me see what Pete from Reading has to say. Pete, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
Actually, I have a lot of my experiences that I wanted to relate to were very, very similar to the previous caller. He kind of stole most of my thunder there.
Oh,
but it seems to me that when you get in life-threatening situations, and for me it's usually been motorcycle accidents,
oh dear,
mostly my own fault, but you go into a high-speed sensory perception mode where you remember every little facet as if you, I mean, the position of your arm when you fell, the position of the front tire, what you thought about you could do to control it, when you tried it, how it failed, what can I try next? And the whole thing takes like 4 seconds in real life, and you look back on it, and it seems like it took 5 minutes for you to actually have the accident.
Well,
and I think there's a trend here if the guest keeps referring to the fact that you're writing memories, and the more memories you write, has a impact on your perception of the passage of time. Every one of these things that you're perceiving at very high speed, hundreds and hundreds of inputs, since you burn them into your memory, maybe it just seems like, okay, well, it must have taken 5 minutes for you to process all that.
Well, that's interesting. People, drive carefully, okay, because motorcycle accidents are certainly a dangerous thing to have. Your thoughts, Claudia?
That's exactly right, what Pete's just said there. That's exactly the mechanism that happens. And so you have this terrifying ordeal. You are trying to save yourself, so you think really fast. This means that there are loads more memories. You remember all those details, just like Pete says. You remember all those things. And then we very much judge how much time has passed by how many new memories we've made, whether it's over a lifetime or something that just took seconds like that. So afterwards, you then think, well, that must have taken a really, really long time because I have all those memories and I remember all those things. And we get very used to judging time by memories and thinking what an average time is like. And of course, this is nowhere an average time. And so that's why it feels as if it took that much longer. You've created all those new memories.
And we're almost out of time here. I'm going to steal Scott's question. Scott from Bucks County. Is there a correlation between time science and the science of pain? When you go through a painful experience, it seems like it'll never end. And then afterwards, you wonder if you ever experienced it.
Yes, it's very interesting. And so, yes, pain, you know, seems so intense at the time, and you're really longing for it to be over. And yet, in a way, pain is something that's difficult to remember. It's hard to remember exactly what that was like. You can remember that it was horrible, but you can't quite remember the intensity of it in the same way. And it's almost as if we're not very good at remembering that intensity. And so, of course, that would then affect time perception as well. And so a really long time in pain might not seem that long when you look back on it.
And what about déjà vu? And we've all had that experience where you feel like something has just sort of repeated itself.
Yeah, there are interesting theories about déjà vu. I mean, one is that it's a mismatch of timing in two of the brain circuits. And so the information, you see something and the information goes from the retina to your visual cortex in the brain that then senses that, and that in a sense you register it before you're slightly consciously aware of it sometimes, and this is when the déjà vu can. So you sort of see a shop window and you think, oh, but I've just seen that shop window. I've seen that before, and actually you did, but you saw it a millisecond before, and it's just that those two parts of the brain and that information getting through doesn't match up, which then gives you that strange feeling of it. When it's something and you think, oh, but I saw that weeks ago, often it is that you saw it weeks ago and that you can't remember that you saw it weeks ago, that we are constantly paying attention to far more things than we realize we're consciously remembering. And so sometimes it is that you really did just see something like this. But it's such an extraordinary experience and such a powerful experience.
I mean, a very vivid experience. I mean, it really, you do have really tricked yourself.
Yes, it is, and it isn't, because then it's unnerving as well, because you sort of think, oh, but I've seen this. How is this possible? Where am I? You know, and it slightly messes with your feelings of reality, so it's slightly confusing.
Well, Claudia Hammond, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been really good.
And Claudia Hammond, author of a new book called Time Warped, and it's subtitled Unlocking the Mysteries of Time Perception. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, Facebook, Twitter, archives, email. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, closing things out with Pink Floyd's classic song, Time, from the 1973 album Dark Side of the Moon.